Welcome to the final installment of this summer's Seminars at Steamboat, lectures on important public policy issues recorded at the Strings Music Pavilion in Steamboat Springs, Colorado. The following seminar features speakers Elaine Kamarek, Director of the Center of Effective Public Management at the Brookings Institution, and Morris P. Fiorina, Senior Fellow at the Hoover Institution, participating in a panel discussion titled The Future of the Democratic and Republican Parties. You'll find a full extended question and answer session from the seminar at KUNC.org. The seminar moderator is NPR Washington correspondent Ron Elving, and it was recorded on August 13th.
I hope that you are as excited to be here as I am. This is absolutely delightful to see a group of people gathered at this point in America's history to discuss the two-party system, to discuss all of the things that proceed from it, positive and negative. And we're going to have a wonderful discussion here featuring two of the finest minds, scholars, authors in American political science today. They're going to each give a presentation, and then we're going to have questions, first from me, then from you. We're going to have this presentation in that fashion and in this order, and it's not really going to be a debate. So those of you who may have that impression, and if that misimpression had been spread by the media, that would certainly be the first time any misimpression has ever been spread. by the media. And we are going to have a discussion that I think you will call many things, but it isn't technically or in a structural sense a debate, and I am not a debate moderator, whatever resemblance to Jim Lehrer I might have. So it is a pleasure to introduce these two people, and I'm going to start with the person who is going to speak first, and that is Morris Fiorina. He is an endowed chair professor at Stanford University and a senior fellow at Hoover Institution. He has taught at Harvard. He grew up in Western Pennsylvania and went to Allegheny College. People in Western Pennsylvania are frequently named Fiorina. There are a number of families with that name. One of those families produced a man who later on married a woman named Carly, who later on went into politics. That is not our guest tonight. For those of you who may have had that impression, just wanted to clear that up. Mo went on to University of Rochester, where he got his PhD, then taught at Harvard. He has been involved in a number of different programs, teaching in a number of different universities, and had a distinguished career. I just want to say one quick thing. You have a program with all of his history in it, but as a journalist and as a teacher, and I'm now teaching at American University, I have made tremendous use of Morris Fiorina's work. Call it stealing, call it homage. We use scholars' work often with attribution, I hope always with attribution, but we are influenced by what we read, and particularly the books that have been the last couple of books in his career. I know he has a new one coming out called Unstable Majorities. He'll share some of that data with us tonight. But a book called Disconnect, you'll find it in the shelves. There's a telephone dangling with a long cord, and it's about how people in representative government aren't really representing people because they don't really listen to their people. They're listening to real folks. Real folks who are organized to be advocates and hyperactivists. They're not listening to all the people that they actually have to represent. And that's a very interesting book. He's also written a book about what culture war is, the title, The Myth of Polarization, and I'm sure that he's going to talk some more about that. So without further ado, an independent thinker, sometimes contrarian thinker, Morris Fiorina.
Thank you, Ron, and thank you all very much for coming. When I was just starting out, a wise old professor told me, never talk about the future until it's already passed. And I want to give you some examples of why I'm going to basically let my colleague do most of the heavy lifting on this tonight. Back in 1936, right after the Roosevelt landslide, Herbert Hoover's former Treasury Secretary wrote to him and said, basically, we're toast. And as it turned out, in the next election, they won 75 seats in the House of Representatives. And basically ended the New Deal. And after the Johnson landslide in 1964, the New Republic published this article. The Republicans won 5 out of the next 6 presidential elections. Arthur Schlesinger, the country's premier historian, wrote this in July of 72. I guess he read the disquietudes of Massachusetts very well, but missed the other 49 states out there. And then more recently, James Carville, a very very, very competent campaign consultant who helped bring Bill Clinton to the presidency. 3 months after Barack Obama's election, wrote this book. In the next election, they lost 63 seats in the House, and Amazon discounted the book by 60%, if you're interested. So, okay, so what I am going to do, and I'm going to talk about the future a little bit toward the end as a segue into my colleague's talk, but I'm going to talk about correcting two major misconceptions that are out there. For 20 years now, we have been told that we are a terribly divided nation, that we simply have no middle ground on the issues, red states versus blue states, the Republicans and Democrats are now two warring tribes. We stand on the brink of a second civil war. I think I'm going to contend that both of these arguments are wrong. And in fact, political scientists and public opinion analysts have really tried in vain to verify anything like this. What is polarization? Well, most things in life follow a normal distribution with a lot in the middle. Polarization is the opposite, where there's very little in the middle and a lot on the extremes. And to do this in practice, how would we look for it? Well, if we talked about ideological polarization, maybe a time one would have a big moderate group and a time two that all have gone to the liberal or the conservative side. If we're talking about a specific issue, say abortion, at time one, there's a lot of people who are somewhere between the never legal and always legal positions. And at time two, everybody has gone to one extreme or the other, always legal or never legal. Or say in partisan polarization, at time one, we have a lot of independents. At time two, they've all become Democrats or Republicans. There's a lot of research that shows that none of these things have occurred. None of these three things have occurred. And let me just show you some of this. This is the ideological self-classifications of the American public since Jimmy Carter's day back here in the 1970s and today. And the top line, black line, you have people calling themselves moderates. It was 40% then, it's 40% today. Liberals, around near 30, not quite, near 30, not quite. Conservatives, a little over 30, a little over 30. So in the space of, what is it now, 40-some years, there's been virtually no movement. This is just sampling error. How about an issue like abortion? Well, the Democratic platform the last two conventions has been anytime, any reason. About 30% of the public agrees with that. Republican platform is never, no exceptions. About 20% of the public agrees with that. And 50% of the public says, well, sometimes, some reasons, that the middle ground is there. And that's true on all the issues we look at. These are from the American National Election Studies, where we ask people to choose their positions on left-right scales. So just to take this red line here, this is healthcare. So there's 12 or 13% who want single payer. There's 12 or 13% who want leave everything to private markets. And as you see, everybody else is in the middle. And that's the way issue after issue comes up like this. If we look at partisanship, it's even sort of worse. These are the partisan self-classifications of the American public going back to 1952. Republicans have never quite gotten back to where they were under Eisenhower. They're at about 28. Democrats have been on a long slide. They're at a little over 30. And the independents have been the big growth group. So people, rather than going to one party or the other, are opting for neither. And there are books, even while the journalists write about warring tribes, there are books written out there about how Americans are increasingly not satisfied and not affiliated with either party. There are two tribes, I've argued, but they're not the two parties. It's the political class versus the general public. And the political class are the people who seek office and run for office, the party officials, donors, activists, partisan media commentators. Yeah. These are the people who behave the way we raise our children not to behave. Yeah. And fortunately, they're a small minority of the American public. Unfortunately, they're the ones who operate the political system. They're the ones who run, they're the ones who nominate, they're the ones who fund, they're the ones who run politics, and they are the public face of politics. If you pay some attention to politics, these are the ones you see on TV or you hear. These people have polarized and sorted. They're about 15% of the public by various measurements. Now, political scientists have always called the general public the mass public. I prefer to call them normal people, since this is about 85% of the voters out there. On the whole, they are inattentive to politics. They are confused about what to do on healthcare or NATO, et cetera. They're ambivalent. They're pro-choice and pro-life at the same time. They're uninvolved politically. and they're concerned with bread and butter issues. Now, I don't mean in any way for these to be criticisms. The reason we have representative democracy is because ordinary people are busy earning a living, raising their families. We elect representatives who are supposed to be our good representatives, who are supposed to be attentive, not confused, not ambivalent, supposed to make the right decisions. So I'm not criticizing, I'm just saying this is the state of play out there. And a lot of you here are probably members of the 1%. And I'm not talking about your income. I'm talking about how many of you subscribe to the New York Times or the Wall Street Journal. There are 235 million eligible voters in this country today. About 1% of them have a subscription, print or digital, to either of these papers. USA Today runs a little higher, but I've never been able to find out whether that includes the freebies at the motels they hand out to you. Okay. Hannity is now the top-rated cable political show on TV, 3.4, so he gets maybe close to 1.5% of the electorate. My political science colleagues at Hoover or at Stanford get upset about Fox News. My Hoover colleagues get upset about Rachel Maddow. I say, don't waste your energy. Their audiences are about 1% of the voting public every day. Anderson Cooper, one particularly bad week last year, his ratings trailed the ratings of Yogi Bear reruns on Nickelodeon. Summer Olympics last summer, 29 million. Yeah. Sunday Night Football, 24 million. What is that? About 10 times as many people watch Sunday Night Football as read the New York Times on Sunday morning. Big Bang Theory just won't go away, about 6 times the size of New York Times. Yeah, basically the stars. Yeah. So most Americans are inattentive. They're not paying attention. Those who are highly unrepresentative. This is the proportion of people giving to campaigns. These are any campaign, from school board right up to the presidency. It's about 10%, and it's been that way since the 1950s. It's much easier to give today, credit cards, internet. People give more often, but it's the same proportion of the people who are giving. Attended a meeting or rally, we're talking single digits here. So if you went to Obama Mania or Trump rallies or any other kind of meetings, 7-8%. If any of you actually made phone calls or knocked on doors, you are really abnormal. We're talking here about 2-3% of the public. So I just want to make this clear about how different the people for whom politics is their everyday concern, their most everyday concern, are from most people. There are young people here, I know, and one of the common observations is, well, it's only you old codgers who are still watching TV and reading newspapers and stuff. We young hipsters, we're getting everything off the internet. There's a lot of research that shows it's actually not true. Out our way, Facebook, a couple years ago, they wanted to study this idea that's very popular out there that people are separating into ideological silos. And so you're only going to liberal websites or conservative websites. So they got permission to follow several million of their Bing toolbar users. They found that only 14% of them clicked on 10 or more news articles in 90 days. That's one article every 9 days they were going to. And because they wanted to see whether they're liberal or conservative, they looked for George Will, Krauthammer, E.J. Dionne, et cetera. They found that 96% read 0 or 1 opinion column in 90 days. Yeah. So the problem was they weren't segregating into ideological audiences. They're not reading anything, basically. They're not getting any information out there. Twitter is the new big thing. And like most new big things, it's way exaggerated. According to Pew Research Center last year, under 4% of U.S. adults say Twitter is an important source of news. A lot of the And by news, by the way, this includes weather, sports, Kim Kardashian, et cetera. They didn't define news here. Katy Perry is the current favorite with 94 million followers. Trump bragged about how many followers he had. Do you remember that? Okay. Britney Spears, Pitbull. I had to Google that one. He's a rapper, if you don't know. And there was Trump at 17 million at the time of the election. You know, so Twitter is vastly exaggerated, like most of these things are. What has happened, and what has really poisoned politics today, and made this situation, my personal view is our politics is in a very sorry state. And what is a process we call party sorting in political science. And that is, we used to have two parties that were big tents. The Democrats were a left of center party, but they had a conservative wing, mostly in the South. And Republicans were a right of center party, but they had a liberal wing, mostly in the Northeast. And so basically it was possible to get together, have bipartisan coalitions and so forth. Nowadays, and this has gone on for about 20, 25 years, if you're a liberal, you're almost certainly going to be in the Democratic Party. If you're conservative, you're almost certainly going to be in the Republican Party. This is definitely a left party and a right party. They're more like the Social Democrats and Christian Democrats that contested elections in the late 19th century European political systems. Much harder to get any kind of cross-party consensus. And basically, the game is now simply to beat the other party, no matter what they're advocating. And there are three features of this sorting process that have been identified. First is it's top-down, that it starts off with the political class. It starts out at the party activists, donors, et cetera, and gradually percolates down into the ordinary partisan identifiers. Second, again, the party platforms on abortion, for example, started diverging in 1976. Until 1992, if you picked a random Democrat or Republican out of the electorate, you couldn't predict whether they're pro-choice or pro-life. They had no relationship to party until the early 90s. It increases the political involvement. The activists are much better sorted than ordinary voters. And it's far from perfect, even among ordinary voters. For example, if you look at strong Democrats, these are the people and strong Republicans who say, I'll move to Canada if the other party gets elected. These are about an eighth of the electorate, a sixth of the electorate. One in five strong Democrats is still arguably very pro-life. Never permit abortion, only in these kinds of cases. Almost one in three strong Republicans is arguably pro-choice, either favoring always. This is 2016 data, of course, for a clear need. So even among the strongest partisans in each party, you still have people who are clearly out of line on important issues in the party. Now, to keep their mouths shut, there's an obvious psychological process. If you think you're the minority in a party, you just simply don't say anything. You know, you're not gonna, if you're a pro-gun Democrat, if you're a pro-choice Republican, you don't talk. The problem is, do two sizes fit all? We have a big heterogeneous democracy, much more heterogeneous than most other democracies on Earth. We've only got two parties. And now just to sort of for purpose of argument, there are public opinion analysts identify three clusters of issues, foreign, defense issues, economic and cultural, and say on foreign, you can take either a cautious stance emphasizing diplomacy or a more aggressive stance. On economic, you can take a pro-government position or a market position. On culture, you could be progressive or traditional. So there are eight actual profiles voters have. Now, the Democrats basically say, you can have this one. Republicans say, you can have this one. If you have any of these views in between, you're going to have to be voting for a party that's wrong for you on at least one cluster of issues. Most other countries have more than two parties. This is just a sample of other democracies. Here in France, you could vote for 17 different parties, for example. That may be, you know, excessive, but in France, this is unusual. Their whole system collapsed the last time around, and Macron rode to the rescue. But when you have more than one party in government, they have to compromise. They have to sort of separate off themselves from the most extreme wings and find common ground. We don't have that anymore, where one party can win complete control of government. The result is the American public is not happy with their party system. Strong partisans are happy, weak partisans less so, independent leaners even less so, independents less so still. That we have a system that is really only representing a chunk of the population. I think Trump benefited from this. As I said, Democrats and Republicans here, you could make an argument really that Trump was anywhere. Based on past comments, past record, that it just wasn't clear. If you're a voter, you could say, I really think Trump is here, or I really think he's here. That I think he did benefit from that. Now, let me just finish with the future of the parties. We have an old party system. Party systems periodically collapse and rejuvenate themselves. Ours starts in the 60s. The Democrats come apart under the pressures of race and Vietnam. Nixon cracks the solid South. Reagan puts together the modern Republican Party, the three stools. The hardline foreign and defense people, the social conservatives on social cultural issues, and the economic conservatives, low taxes and deregulation. All those three stools are weak now, they're wobbling. Republicans have typically gotten most of the discussion lately. The defense, both the collapse of the Soviet Union as an existential threat, followed by the wars in Afghanistan and Iraq, have made a lot of people rethink the whole idea of an interventionist foreign policy. Trump actually did clearly take some advantage of that. The younger generation simply is not into the social issues in the same way the older generation is, so they're losing ground there on the social issues. The economic issues, the Great Recession and the rise in inequality have called into question some of the free market, low tax, deregulation of people. So they're all sort of on the defensive in the Republican Party. They used to be the party of business and a prudent fiscal and foreign policy. Now there's a whole collection of ideological cause groups, whites, religious people, both of which are declining in the population. The Democrats cracked up in quite a good way in the 60s. McGovern was a result of that. Bill Clinton pulled them back into the mainstream. Today, the progressives are there, and Elena's going to talk about this. They used to be the party of working people, now ideological cause groups, minorities, and increasing emphasis on diversity and identity politics. These are divisive issues. If you are one of the 1% that read the New York Times, Tom Etzel had a column last week in which he talked about the problems of the party. And VSG is the Voter Study Group, which is a big survey organization, bipartisan. Do I have 1 minute left? Okay. On the last election, they did a big cluster analysis of the kinds of voters out there. And they separated them the computer separates them into five groups. And the first group is what they call the Democrat Independent Liberal Elites, about 15% of the voters. And they're very heavily Democratic, younger, whiter, highly educated. If they voted in the primaries, they supported Sanders. The second group is the more old-time Democrats, 25% of the population, still mostly Democratic, but also lots of independents, Republicans, older, diverse, less educated. They tended to support Hillary Clinton if they voted in the primaries. That's 40%, so you win the election by holding those and getting a majority here. These are moderate, younger, middle-income people. They are basically across the board in all the different party groups, younger, female. They tend to be politically inactive. And then on the Republican side, they had the older conservatives who supported Trump, and the younger conservatives who were pretty similar. They're basically just simply younger, and they were more ideological. So those were the groups. And what was really fascinating is if you looked at what they thought were the primary priorities facing the nation, here's what it looked like. The 85%, four groups, had jobs and the economy in their top five. The only group that didn't was the Democratic liberal elites here. For them, the economy was 10 and jobs were 14. These are people who are economically secure. They often tend to work in the public sector, government. They don't get hit as hard by recessions. They have basically the security to worry about the environment, climate change, the broader, more abstract issues. And then if you turn it around, that's out of 23 issues. What are the bottom issues? And that's also very interesting. Gay rights, and by the way, I want to point out, these are not, I'm simply saying this is what the American people told the interviewers. I'm not saying what should be or shouldn't be high priority. Gay rights was in the bottom five of four of the five groups. Gender equality was in the bottom five of three groups, and it was only 14 for this group. Racial equality was in the bottom five for these two groups, and was only 18th here. And abortion, surprisingly, was not that big an issue. Given all the press it receives, it's low here, even among these groups. It's low among the two, middling among the two conservative groups, 14. And even among the DILE, it wasn't that. So this is what Edsel was talking about in his article in the New York Times, that there's a tension between being a mass party and winning an election in a two-party system, and being essentially the spearhead of crusades for social justice, which almost by definition involve minorities, which is what we're showing here. And so I think, basically this is the new problem, the newer problem facing the Democrats, and Elena is going to talk quite a good bit about this. So thank you, and we'll talk later. Thank you. You want this? Thank you.
Thank you, Mo, for that marvelous tour of the horizon and rapid fire tour through all that data. And thank you also for mentioning people who blather, vent, and vilify, and only mentioning TV, Facebook, and Twitter. We in public radio appreciate that. Now, these two individuals, they work for different institutions, they work on different coasts, but they share a great deal in terms of their academic interests, and also they share a professor that they both got to know, both through Berkeley, which is where our next guest got her PhD, and also teaching at Harvard, which both our two guests have done, and his name was Nelson Poulsby. And he was an extraordinary, cantankerous, enormous, overwhelming man who really influenced an awful lot of people in academia, in political science, and certainly in journalism as well. So the achievements of some of his colleagues, I think, stand as a tribute to him tonight. Elaine is senior fellow in the Governance Studies Department at Brookings Institution. She has also taught for many years at the Kennedy School of Government at Harvard. Her books include Primary Politics, Everything You Need to Know About How America Nominates Its Presidential Candidates. And let me tell you, that is very useful for students who think that these candidates have sprung from the mind, not of God, but of some kind of gods somewhere. The same people who think that they themselves are the products of Immaculate Conception, perhaps. It is wonderful to be able to hand them a book of this kind and have all their questions answered. She has also written a very influential book that is quite new and that you should know about, and it's called Why Presidents Fail and How They Can Succeed Again. And not to take anything away from what you may be willing to share with us in just a moment, but just to say that part of her thesis is that the government is a big thing that you need to know and need to manage. And it's not enough to just go on campaigning after you have won the office. And it is now time to run the country as best you can. And I should quickly add that this is a book that's been in the works for some time and does not apply to any one particular individual. So with that, I give you Elaine Kmart.
Thank you very much. So I want to now switch and talk about that 1%, the political class, and what's been happening in the political class and to the political class. To understand political parties, we have to understand factions. That's particularly true in the American system, where the political party, we only have two because of our winner-take-all system. We only have two parties. We're likely to only have two parties in the future. So you have to understand not just what's going on in between the parties. You have to understand at any given point in time what is going on within the parties. And so we start with the Republicans, okay? In 2010, the Tea Party becomes an important faction in the Republican Party. So important that, in fact, it really upsets the apple cart in the place where the Republican Party governs, which is the Republican caucus in the House of Representatives. Now, I said I'm going to take you inside. Mo took you outside. I'm going to take you way inside. What happens in Congress happens in the caucuses. And if you don't kind of know what's happening in the caucuses, things might seem a little bit mysterious to you. Here we have a headline from Roll Call from October of 2015. The GOP plagued by the Tea Party monster it created. And all you have to know is that the Tea Party faction within the Republican caucus created a great deal of sorus, as we say, for the Speaker of the House, particularly John Boehner, and then for his successor. Boehner was only the fifth Speaker of the House to resign in the middle of his term in 226 years. 226 years, okay? People love being Speaker. It's a great job. It makes the whole thing happen. In some ways, it's as consequential or more than being president, and it is third in line in the Constitution in succession. So for the Republican Party to lose two speakers in the space of 5 years, this is very unusual. This didn't happen very often in American politics. And most of the time, the other speakers who left, they left because they got appointed Secretary of State, they died, one of them actually lost his race back home. In other words, this is quite unusual. Now, you have to ask yourself, what is going on within that party? In 2011, the year after the Congress that adjourned, that opened up in 2011, the year after 2010, the Tea Party caucus could only count 60 members out of 242 Republican members, or 25% of the total. The Tea Party name sort of lost its allure over the years, and by 2015, people with that same attitude were now calling themselves the Freedom Caucus. And the Freedom Caucus consisted of 36 out of 247 Republican members. So you have to ask yourself, why was the legislative tail able to wag the dog? Okay, which is, I think it's really the most important question if you're looking inside at the elites. Well, I have four explanations. They're the four P's: primaries, pork, party money, and privacy. Primaries in legislative districts that tend to be controlled by one party through gerrymandering, sometimes through gerrymandering, but also through just sorting, demographic sorting. People, surprise, surprise, like to live near people like themselves. Okay, gerrymandering is a big bad bugaboo, but frankly, it doesn't explain the whole thing here. So when you have an increasing number of safe congressional districts, which we have had for several decades now, guess what? The action is in the primary. That's where the action is. And the member of Congress says to himself or herself, I can get beat in a primary. I'm not going to get beat. If I'm a Dem, I'm not getting beat in Cambridge, Massachusetts. If I'm a Republican, I'm not getting beat, you know, in some place in Nebraska. Okay? Where can I get beat? In the primary. And so primaries have very few people voting in them, and the people voting in them are the strong Democrats, the strong Republicans that Mo was talking about. So that's one fear. There's a tendency to move towards the extremes in each party. Pork is the second reason. In a rush of feeling good about themselves, Congress decided that earmarks were terrible and that we shouldn't waste any more money. That was a huge waste of taxpayer money. Now, can I tell you how infinitesimal earmarks were in the scope of a $14 trillion federal budget? They were bupkis, as we would say. Okay, nothing. And yet, they were critical legislative grease. Well, without a speaker being able to offer earmarks, you can't go to somebody and say, I know this vote is hard for you, but this is the compromise we've reached. Please vote for it, and we're going to give you a new library in your district or whatever. So pork is the second. The third is party money. Again, in an effort to reform things, the legislature got rid of the special place the political parties used to hold in terms of being able to raise and give contribute money. And now, under the law today, political parties are just like anybody else. They're just like any other billionaire-backed political action group, or 527, or whatever you want to call them, or super PAC. And once you denigrated parties, then the speaker, right, or the legislative leader, didn't have any special thing to give out. There was no special financial tool that they had for governing. And finally, privacy. Expecting people to be able to cut a controversial deal in hearings that are open to the public or that are on television is simply insane. And every one of you who's been in the business world and has had to negotiate knows that privacy is essential to negotiation. Everybody knows that for the rest of the world, and for some reason people decided that it was bad for politics. So what you've had is four movements, all of which are well-intentioned, which in fact enable a small faction in the Republican caucus to have caused a great deal of dysfunction in the United States Congress. Now, what this is called by my colleagues, Tom Mann and Norm Ornstein, is asymmetric polarization. They have argued that the Republicans are more to blame than the Democrats for the dysfunction in Congress. And it is clear that this tail wagging the dog phenomenon in the Republican caucus has made it extraordinarily difficult for the Democrats to, for Republicans to meet the Democrats on any piece of legislation. And so we've had some pretty close calls and some pretty bad legislation, the tax bill being one of them. But the question we all face now is, will the Democrats experience a similar factional divide? Just because one party seems to have really angry people in it who refuse to compromise and who don't believe in compromise, does it mean that this is somehow contagious? Is dysfunction contagious? Are the Democrats going to also become a party where the tail is wagging the dog? Obviously, Sanders, Bernie Sanders, and has introduced into the Democratic Party a new and phenomenal energy. He brought a lot of young people into the party. There's no doubt that there is a Sanders wing of the party. The question is this different from the Ted Kennedy wing of the party or the Paul Wellstone wing of the party? And this is just playing out as we speak. For instance, here is some research that we're doing at Brookings. At Brookings, ever since 2014, we have been looking at the websites of every single candidate who runs for Congress in both parties. And we have been coding their websites according to what they call themselves, okay? Not, in other words, we don't make judgments. We look for what they call themselves. 2014, there were a very small number of Democratic challengers. These are all non-incumbents. And of those, only 17%, a small number, called themselves progressives, and an even smaller number won their primaries. Those numbers stayed about the same in 2016, although you had slightly more progressive non-incumbent challengers. Here's the big change. First of all, in 2018, you have an enormous number of people running for Congress in the Democratic Party. The numbers just jump. Of those people, you have a substantial number who call themselves progressives, and we code these by, you know, did they have a picture of themselves with Bernie Sanders on their website, right? Have they been endorsed by Our Revolution or Justice for All? You know, there's a variety of ways that we code them. And they're doing fairly well. They are winning primaries, but frankly, they're not winning as much as establishment candidates are. So this comes from, this is our most recent adding up of what's going on. There's three more weeks of primaries. So we've got most of the people, not all of them. The people that we have categorized as establishment candidates, again, these are only challengers, are winning their races about 31%, 32% of the time. The people categorized as progressives are winning their races about 23 or 24% of the time. So, in other words, the progressives are winning, but they are not winning as often as these more establishment candidates. Secondly, if we look at where the progressives are winning, some of them are, let me just take you back a bit. I mean, Mo knows this, but I'm not sure anybody else knows this. There's a wonderful measure called the Cook PVI, Partisan Voter Index. It's a way of looking at history and saying this district has a tendency to be Democratic, tendency to be Republican. So if you have the PVI of R plus 20, it means that Jesus himself would have a hard time running as a Democrat and winning in that district, okay? That's how to look at that. And a D plus 40, it's the same thing. You couldn't run as a Republican and win. So What we see is there's a fair number of winners who are in these even districts. These are the swing districts, the purple districts you'll hear people talking about, okay? So this could be a pretty good pickup for some progressives. There's even more running in slightly Republican districts, and there are some running in these very, very Republican districts. So unless if there's a blue wave, you're not likely to see many from this column, and you're not likely to see many from this column. If there's a blue tsunami, as opposed to a wave, you might see more from this column. So in other words, where I'm going is that we want to ask, what does this mean for the future of the Democrats? What does it mean for the future of the Democratic Party? Are they going to become the mirror image of the Republican Party? Okay, are they going to have, in the Democratic caucus that meets next January, are they going to have the same ideologically fraught battles? Are they going to have the same civil war that's been going on within the Republican Party? Are we going to see two Democratic speakers tossed out on their heads, right? What does it mean? And it really does, there are some people who think, well, you know, the other party has gone crazy, so we have to be crazy too. We have to be crazy to compete. And there's two issues that have come up in this, which I think are kind of interesting. One is Medicare for all, okay? So far, now this was about 3 weeks ago, but it gives you a sense of where they are. All the Democrats, these are the candidates who've won their primaries, 44% support Medicare for all. Those who identify as progressives, 70% support Medicare for all. Those who identify as establishment candidates, 32%. By the way, these include incumbents as well as non-incumbents. And that's important because there is this little problem in politics, and it's called reality. Medicare for all is a great term. It makes the heart beat faster for many, many progressives. It is really hard to do, okay? It's just when you start asking these questions, it becomes pretty difficult and maybe impossible. And so the question is, for the Democrats, when they meet in that caucus, will the progressives come around to that and compromise and try to, you know, work out something that expands healthcare, does some more good for healthcare, but is somewhat short of Medicare for all? Or will they behave as the Tea Party and Freedom Republicans have behaved within their caucus, okay? With the attendant dead bodies of the leadership, politically dead bodies of the leadership, strewn around. The second idea that is maybe the worst idea after building a wall on the border, the second idea to come out of politics this season has been, oops. The second idea is the idea to abolish ICE. ICE is the Border Patrol agency. This is Alexandria Ocasio-Cortez, who made that surprise win in the Bronx, upsetting an established member of Congress. She's overnight a hero of the left. She's been all over the country, and she has convinced other people who should know better, like Kamala Harris, Senator Kamala Harris, and Senator Kristen Gillibrand, that we should abolish ICE. It is the damn stupidest thing I have ever heard, okay? I mean, what would you do with the border? Just have an open border, okay? Now, again, this is what I mean by this tendency towards extremes. So the Republican Party is led by a president who wants to close the border so badly that he presides over totally inhumane practices of separating children from families at the border. That's terrible. Most of the public thought it was terrible. I think it's terrible.
So then some Democrats decide that they have to go crazy too. And they have to open borders. Now, nobody in America wants open borders, okay? It is not a realistic policy proposal. And yet, there are people that are promoting this. So that's the question before us, right? The question is the Democratic Party going to fracture, are its elites going to fracture in ways that make them look as nutty to those people that Mo talked about, who really would rather have a more sensible government? Is the Democratic Party going to go what nutty way is the Republican Party? Or are they going to be, when they take over the House, which I expect they will, or are they going to be a different kind of party and try to do something that more resembles productive government? Two more slides I just want to show you as we're going into the future. And Mo is completely right. We should never try to predict the future, but if we didn't, then it would be no fun. So here is, and this has been a constant of public opinion polling. This is a Pew polls. These are Trump approval by age from earlier this year. Red is disapproved, blue is approved. 18 to 29-year-olds don't like this guy. They don't like him at all. 30 to 49-year-olds ain't so crazy about him either. 50 to 64-year-olds are split, 65-year-olds and up, again, are more or less split. Okay, so there is a real generation gap. Now, that overlaps with some other things. This generation, particularly these, are the most diverse generation in American history. In other words, there's more brown, black, Asians in this generation than ever in American history. So that is obviously contributing to it. And of course, there's another gap that I didn't put in here that is growing and enormous, and that's a gender gap. Even when you take out African-American women who are very anti-Trump, women don't like this guy either. Okay, so we have a I mean, let's face it, he's every bully we've ever encountered in our lives, right? And women don't like him much either. But then go to this, which I'm sorry, it didn't come out very well, but this is a poll of young people, okay, and ages 15 to 34. And look down here. Does Donald Trump reflect my personal values? 72%, nope, he doesn't. And only 9% thinks he does. Is he making America great again? Only 14% thinks he does. Does he care about the forgotten people of the country? Nope. Is he representative of the Republican Party? Not many people think so. Okay, so young people are really not thrilled with this guy, and frankly, that's about as far as we can go in predicting the future. I tend to be an optimist. I don't think I want there to be a functioning Republican Party. I don't think under Trump we have a functioning Republican Party. But I also think that Trump will be repudiated in the coming years in one way or another, and that we will have a return to normalcy in our politics. And when we have a return to normalcy, some of the people that Mo was talking about who are in the middle and are despairing at what they see in Washington might not be quite as despairing again. So if this comes true, I want you to remember that I said it here. If it doesn't come true, I want you to remember that I had on a great maroon silk blouse, okay? And that'll be the end of that. Thank you very much.
So would each of you tell me one thing that if it were in your power to change, you would change about the way we select our candidates for office in America?
Well, this is unconstitutional. That's the problem.
Yeah, yeah. Oops.
Yeah. And And I also recognize that 40 years ago, I thought the problem was the other way. But one of the things that has contributed to this nationalization of American politics, where one Republican from Ohio is the same as a Republican from Oregon, a Democrat from New Jersey is the same as one from New Mexico, is the nationalization of funding. That, you know, basically a whole lot of Republican money comes out of Texas, a whole lot of Democratic money comes out of Hollywood and New York. And the donors can impose a national agenda on candidates for vastly different reasons. So if you had basically like a provision that said you can only take money from people who reside in your district, whatever it is, your state, your district, then a Colorado Republican would be different from a Texas or South Carolina Republican, and the same for Democrats.
That's a great idea, and I second that. And I think that would be a very successful way to do it. I have an even more unusual idea, which is some people are going to hate, but I would return more power over party nominations to institutional political parties. What happens right now is you have a small group, sometimes we're talking single digits in a district, who vote in primaries and select the nominees. And oftentimes the institutional party is kind of embarrassed by who gets nominated. If you'll remember in 2010, the Republicans lost a Senate seat that should have been theirs because they nominated a woman who called herself a witch and then had to deny being a witch. There's a lot of weird stuff that happens in primaries. And I think that, and whereas political parties have an ongoing institutional interest in winning elections. That's why they exist. And I think it would be helpful, and I've got a piece coming out in the New York University Law Review about this in presidential politics, if we returned some more control to institutional political parties. By the way, that's the way it used to be for most of American history, and we didn't do so bad.
Yeah. I'm quoting here, I think, Elaine, have you not said in the past a list of illustrious presidents who were nominated essentially by superdelegates?
Oh, all of them. Roosevelt, Eisenhower, okay. There's this big brouhaha about superdelegates. And literally until 1972, both political parties had nothing to do with primaries, okay? The presidential primaries that existed in the 50s were not beauty contests. They were not primaries that elected delegates. They were beauty contests. They were roundly ignored by everybody in the political system, and the decisions were made by party people at conventions. So if you go back and look at the presidents nominated that we all now love, they were nominated by Republicans and Democrats in that way.
What is the role of third parties in our current political environment? A real alternative or as spoilers? Mel?
Well, often they are spoilers, but I think if you look historically, what third parties have done in American democracy is they have pushed one or the other party in a certain direction. And so most of the time what happens to a third party is it kind of gets eaten up by one of the major political parties. There's still some spoilers, but you know, for instance, there's not an awful lot of difference between the platform of the Democratic Party and the Green Party. Now, they still exist. They have been spoilers in some instances. But the fact of the matter is that if you want the environmental party these days, it's the Democratic Party, for better or for worse, right, depending on your politics. So the third parties do tend to push the parties, and they do tend to push them in the direction of certain issues, but they don't, other than sometimes when it's very close, they're not going to become major parties.
Mo, what's your thought on this?
I agree with all of that. The only thing I'd add is that I think the time has never been riper. The time has never been, there been more need for a third party. And I'd really like to see the third party totally crash the party system. I mean, I agree. They tend to be spoilers. They tend to be picked in by the other parties, but the Republicans in the 1850s destroyed the Whigs and Know-Nothings and others who were around at the time. And I just think we have a system that simply doesn't fit the 21st century. It's a system that was born in the 60s and developed in the 80s. And man, do we need sort of a different alignment. And so out of the ashes, I'd hope some more sensible coalitions would emerge.
Can I say one thing on that? The problem with doing that, because I know some friends of mine have written books to this effect, et cetera, is that the Democratic and Republican parties are very handy clues to what you believe, right? If you believe, going back to your data, if you believe in choice for women, then you're going to be a Democrat. If you think abortion is really, really bad, then you're going to be a Republican. And you don't have to spend a lot of time and away from your normal life. You don't have to spend a lot of time sort of figuring out what the positions are. We Americans, even though they don't read the newspapers, et cetera, they got a general sense of what the Democrats are, what the Republicans are. Now, the problem with breaking that up is no one knows what independents are. Nobody knows. How do independents stand on size of government? How do independents stand on fracking? How do independents stand on abortion or on health care for all? Nobody knows what that is. So to have a third party, to really break up the party, you would need actually something that had a coherent set of ideas, and you'd have to work really hard at it year after year, and nobody's done it.
I agree with the argument that parties clarify choices for the voters. I'd have more sympathy for it if there were more than two of them. If there were four or five clear parties, but as they say, we're being forced into these two choices, which I, for one, simply never am happy with, what I rarely am happy with when I go out there.
Several of you have asked about the tone of political discourse in our country today. One question is, given the alarming tone political discourse has taken, what do either of you suggest to counteract it? A number of people have also talked about gatherings of friends and family and how difficult it is to talk about anything in the public sphere. Anything you could suggest to counteract the current state of our political discourse?
Well, I'd say everybody should quit watching CNN and cable TV and for a start, you know, just sort of and realize that this is simply not representative of people out there. But I think people don't, there's not enough interaction anymore. I mean, I don't mean, Ron, I apologize for saying this, but I always tell our graduate students, don't listen to NPR, listen to AM channels. You know, you got to sort of listen to what's out there, listen to Howard Stern, listen to all these other channels out there, because you're not sort of getting the pulse of America in the kind of outlets people tend to listen to. But I mean, the breakdown in civility is not just in politics. It sort of permeates our system, and I don't think, I don't know what we can really do about that. Fortunately, most people in their real lives don't behave like that.
I do think that the internet has contributed to the breakdown in civility just because of the anonymity of it. I mean, when I publish things in the broader press, you know, I get the most awful, awful emails. Just rude and mean and very sexist. And, you know, I know that most of the time these people wouldn't say that to me face to face. You know, but I think they feel free to do that.
Thank you. Thank you both.
This has been a special presentation of Seminars at Steamboat. You can find the extended question and answer session at our website, kunc.org. For more information about the seminars, visit seminarsatsteamboat.org. The radio broadcast was produced by Ryan Thompson for KUNC. Special thanks to Bob Stein, Jenny Lay, the Steamboat pilot and today, and the staff of the Strings Music Pavilion for their support. Music by Scott Holmes. For more information, visit seminarsatsteamboat.org. This is KUNC.
This is KUNC 91.5 Greeley, Fort Collins.
KRNC 88.5 Steamboat Springs.
KVNC 90.9 Minturn Vale.
KENC 90.7 Estes Park.
And KMPB 90.7 Breckenridge.